Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Outdoor Equestrian Podcast. I'm your host, Remy Kelble, and today I get to interview Wes Seiler. He has contributed to various magazines, such as Outdoor Life, Outside Magazine, Road and Track, and GQ. He's also appeared on channels like ABC, CBS, and Fox News. So thank you so much for joining the Outdoor Equestrian Podcast today, and here's the interview.
Hey, Remy, how are you?
I'm good. How are you today?
Can't complain.
So I really appreciate you doing this today.
Absolutely. Always happy to help with stuff like this. Awesome. Tell me more about the podcast.
Yeah, so I interview people in the outdoor and equine industry, mainly like media companies. So I've interviewed people from Outside Magazine, Discovery Channel, National Geographic, and then people in the FEI, which is a huge horse organization internationally, and they do big horse shows around the world.
Cool. That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you. So I know that you live in Bozeman, Montana, which I think is really cool because I love that state. But you...
It's a cool spot, yeah.
Yeah. And I know that you have grown up in big cities, though. So you always had to travel out of your way to get outdoors and into nature. So what about Montana do you love, and was it a big jump for you moving there out of cities like New York and Los Angeles?
Yeah, so I spent the second half of my childhood actually growing up on a little horse farm in southern New York.
Oh, wow.
So that was really cool. Southern New York isn't terribly wild, but it is very picturesque. And I went to university in London, and then lived there for the early part of my career, then New York City, and then Los Angeles. And then 3 years ago, right about now, my now wife came up with the crazy idea of moving to Montana. So we just kind of moved up here.
So it was like spontaneous?
It was not totally spontaneous, but it was just sort of, we just decided to do it and we did it.
Okay. Wow.
Probably took like 3 months from beginning to end of like, hey, let's move to Montana, and then like actually packing the truck and moving up here.
So how did you get prepared for that? Because is your wife from big cities too?
Yeah, she's from Dallas and lived in Seattle and Los Angeles as well. But okay. She grew up coming to Montana on vacation because her mom's from here.
Oh.
So she was probably more prepared for this than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And knew more about the state. I never even into Montana before we started talking about moving here. This was empty space on the map for me. I figured it was, you know, Nebraska.
Uh-huh. Oh my gosh. So you weren't prepared at all, really?
I mean, I wasn't prepared at all, but I'm pretty good at making stuff up as I go along.
Yeah.
You know, we got up here and just, you know, started enjoying ourselves, and it's been a dream.
That is so cool. Well, that's very interesting. Do you think coming from a big city, like, how did you prepare for a move, like, to Montana?
Well, you know, like, I obviously work in the outdoor world and have done outdoor stuff forever, mm-hmm. So it wasn't necessarily, like, a huge adaptation from that. It just means that the stuff that used to hop in the car and, you know, drive a couple hours to get to is now, you know, 5 minutes away. And
okay.
There means we can do stuff every day. That's, you know, really epic and really incredible. And then just come home and cook dinner instead of having to have the, you know, once a month trip or a weekend trip or something.
Okay. Because I know in one of your videos for Rewilding, you said that you live close to grizzly bears and wolves. So how do you deal with that?
Well, you know, if they're not really, you always have to sort of be aware that it might be an animal conflict sometimes when mm-hmm. you're out there.
Mm-hmm.
But like the same way that, you know, we've all gone backpacking and camping in mountains that have black bears, you just take reasonable precautions. So just like black bears, you know, you keep your food smells, you know, at a minimum. You put your food away somewhere safe at night. You know, you make noise as you hike through dense brush. You try to avoid, you know, the really dense stuff where a bear might not be able to see you, or especially dense brush near a running stream where it might not be able to hear you or see you. It's really the surprises that create aggressive encounters with animals. surprises is sort of like just becomes part of your routine. You just think about, you know, what exact terrain you're hiking through. You know, hey, do I need to hike through that thick stuff at the bottom of the hill, or can I walk halfway up the hill and go to the open meadow?
Mm-hmm.
And so that really becomes a dynamic there. Wolves are not something, you know, to be scared of at all. Mm-hmm. There's no documented cases of wolves killing humans in any sort of reasonable capacity. So it's just, you know, it's really, really neat on the rare occasions. It's very rare to see them. But it is, you know, a really welcome surprise when you do see one at a distance.
Okay. That sounds so cool. I love nature, so I think that would be interesting to see outdoors, but I don't think you'd want to run into a grizzly. So
you don't want to run into a grizzly. I think most encounters with them are just sort of, you know, you're both surprised, and you know, you just sort of back off and leave the area. You know, that's probably 99% of human grizzly encounters are something like that. They're not something to be hugely afraid of. They're just, you know, you're just being aware of their presence and, you know, prepared to, you know, back away or leave or make yourself safe in some capacity if you know, you do have sort of an encounter.
Okay. And I wonder, I'm curious as to how many attacks have there been on humans in Montana? Do you know?
Oh, we usually have, like, you know, like 3 or 4 a year.
Okay.
A lot of them are here in southwest Montana, since we're just outside the park.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we sort of have a greater density of grizzly bears. A lot of the attacks occur people bow hunting. Mm-hmm. So bow hunting season coincides with the time of the year when grizzlies are really trying to pack on calories for the winter. And so they're very active. They're active in the same area where we're hunting elk. And then, you know, we're sneaking around the woods trying to be as quiet as possible. So, you know, your chances of having that really close-up surprise encounter that can lead to, you know, aggression or an attack is your highest for bow hunters. So most of the time, those 3 or 4 attacks are, you know, on hunters.
Okay. And then, as someone who lives in Montana, how do you think you would prepare for, like, I know you've been camping since you were 5 years old. And then I know, of course, you like to hike. So how would you prepare for camping and hiking within the outdoors of Montana when there's grizzly bears around?
So there's a lot of disinformation out there about grizzly bears from people of sort of all political stripes.
Mm-hmm.
From sort of the animal conservation people, which, you know, sort of my background, you know, and I agree with a lot of what they do. They want to put out a message where, you know, bear spray is something that anybody can carry, you don't need to practice with, and, you know, that it can be effective in an attack. And there's 2 studies that were done by the same scientists a decade or 2 ago that have similar titles, the efficacy of bear spray and the efficacy of firearms. And the way that information is often presented to the public is very flawed. And the studies weren't meant to be compared. They have very disparate methodologies. And so there's, you know, the idea that bear spray is a one-stop solution of recreating safely in grizzly country is very flawed, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the numbers, you know, bear spray really cannot be demonstrated to be effective in an actual grizzly attack. It's very effective if there's a bear, like, that's curious or sniffing around for food, or you're just sort of lingering in the area. You know, bear spray is a very effective non-lethal tool for humans and that bear to leave you alone. But in an actual, you know, close-up, you know, bear jumps out of the bushes and tries to bite your face off attack, bear spray cannot be demonstrated to be effective according to science. What can be demonstrated to be very effective is remaining grouped, recreating in groups. So there's really, according to the scientists who study, there's no recorded instances whatsoever where a group of 2 or more people remains shoulder to shoulder and a grizzly actually make contact. And so to me, that's the most effective sort of survival advice out there is, you know, like, if you just stay together, if you avoid areas where surprise attacks can happen, you know, really dense brush, and you just sort of keep your head on a swivel and look around and try to pull up trouble, that's much more effective than stick with your indoor activities.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's very interesting.
I also carry a gun.
Yeah, good.
Do not ever want to shoot a bear.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it just sort of a backup.
Yeah.
In case there's a really, really serious life threatening incident.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I've grown up in Colorado, so I don't have to worry about grizzlies. But I love to go hiking and camping. So I definitely love to be prepared for those kind of things and learn more. So thank you.
Of course. And my advice to everybody is just don't be scared. Mm-hmm. Read up on practical precautions you can take. You're made aware while you're out there. But there's no reason to be scared or have it put you off.
Okay.
Awesome. It's like swimming in the ocean. There's sharks in there, but they're probably not going to bite you.
Yeah. Okay, and then I know that you're an outdoor adventure journalist, so you've contributed to various magazines such as Outdoor Life, Road and Track, and GQ, and you've also appeared on channels like ABC, CBS, CNN, and Fox News. So tell me about one of your favorite opportunities you have gotten as an outdoor adventure journalist.
it's not necessarily like the TV appearances and stuff that sort of like satisfy me career wise. It's fun, and it's a fun little ego stroke. But I really like getting to call, enjoying a really good lifestyle and career. And so creating that job where I can spend time with my wife and my dogs and my friends and people that I love in the outdoors doing exciting things is what I find most satisfying. It's fun going on TV. I went on a couple of years ago on CNN a lot around the Susquehanna lion controversy when that famous lion was killed in Africa. That was enjoyable. And I got to hang around and do parts of the segment that were also on like religion and how it sort of hurts people in America. So I do enjoy the appearance and I do enjoy sort of the attention, but it's really just being able to do fun stuff with people that I love is the most rewarding thing.
Okay. And tell me about that lion.
Cecil the lion was killed by an American dentist named Walter Palmer years ago, probably 5 or 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was very controversial. People generally that aren't super aware of hunting issues tend to have a very negative perception of hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a shame because hunting actually provides tools to animal conservation. That works very differently in Africa than how it works here. Our sport hunting system here in America is really, really sound and really ethical and really friendly on the animals. And it's not about trophies. It's sort of about sustainable meats and sustainable wildlife conservation practices. Whereas in Africa, hunting is like a high dollar, trophy, yielding the lion kind of thing. But in Africa, lands have to be set aside for wildlife habitat and not farms. And so attaching a commercial value to a species like lion or like elephants, even though we sort of look at the Americas and you don't want to kill, attaching that commercial value to them is what sets aside private land for conservation and protects that land from poaching and sort of exploitation. And so everybody gets upset when a famous lion's killed, but it actually works against the interests of lion conservation. So I sort of went on TV for a while and made that point to a lot of people.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't very popular.
Well, that's very interesting, though. Did you study wildlife conservation in college?
No, I studied journalism and marketing. I've just always been really fascinated by animals and really love them. And so learning the sort of the realistic nature of animal conservation and not just sort of thinking that it's just a Disney movie out there, I think was the most important thing I did.
Okay. Very interesting. Because I know at CSU, they have a big vet school. And the vet students got to work on a grizzly bear. And I don't know exactly what happened, but it's very interesting. And I thought that was very interesting to read about, so...
Oh, that's actually really exciting. I would love to see something like that in action. That would be cool.
I know. So I know that you run a lifestyle column called Indefinitely Wild, and you tell the stories of adventure travel in the outdoors. So how did you start that?
So a few years ago, I guess the full backstory is, I wasn't always an outdoor journalist. I worked in the car industry and motorcycles for a long time. And when I actually did my last motorcycle publication, I knew I wanted to do something different. I was really just really fed up with that world. And I'd always really enjoyed doing outdoor stuff. I never thought it could be a viable career. So I called one of my mentors, this guy named Brian Lamb, who started a site called The Wirecutter and used to run Gizmodo. And he was like, Wes, just go make an outdoor site. You can do it. It'll be great. And I was like, really? And he's like, yes. And so I just did that. And so I did create a website called Indefinitely Wild that was a part of the Coffee Media Network. And did that for a couple of years, grew a good audience, and then Outside came looking for me, and worked out me a transfer over there.
Wow, that's so interesting. That sounds like a lot of fun too. You must have gotten a lot of networking opportunities with that column.
Oh yeah, I mean that's one of the funnest things about being a journalist is that you get to meet such a variety of different people and talk to experts and have them open up to you. It's really fascinating. I can just pick up the phone and I can call like, hey, I'm writing a story about polar bears. I can call the world's best polar bear scientist and getting like hear his perspective and his experiences or anybody else like that. It's just it's really cool getting to do that stuff.
Awesome. And I know that I love one of the photographers, Paul Nicklin, for National Geographic. And he does a lot of polar bears and Arctic, in the Arctic region. So I just love following his career, and I think that's so interesting how he got there too.
Yeah, it's very cool. I love following his Instagram. It's just super fun getting to see all those great pictures of animals every day.
And he provides these like great facts about the wildlife conservation and how we can protect the polar bears in the Arctic. And I just think that's so important to learn because I didn't know that. So.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Polar bears, one of those things that have really been politicized over the years, and so there's a lot of disinformation out there about sort of what their struggles are. The big fear with polar bears is they are directly endangered by the loss of sea ice, and so we can only make their population sustainable, past this century if we actually take effective action on global warming. And that's so the goal is to make life as easy on the polar bears as possible in the meantime, to avoid losing any on land, avoid any more habitat destruction on land, and then overall try to work towards climate solutions that would allow them to continue to live.
And I know that he took a picture of an emancipated polar bear. I mean, it was like you could see its ribs. It was really, really bad. And he said that was due to
It's human,
climate change.
yeah.
So do you know how those that links together?
Yeah, so polar bears need sea ice to hunt. They eat seals, and they can only catch the seals when there's solid ice, and the seals are basically limited to a few sort of air holes to come up for air, and then they can stalk or hide out and ambush on one of those air holes and catch the seal. And if that ice doesn't exist, they can't successfully hunt the seal. They don't have another food source that's sort of evolutionarily enabled to hunt. And so, that famous picture of the super emaciated bear was just there was no sea ice in that area at the time, and he was unable to find food.
Oh, wow. That's so
Yes, yeah,
sad.
so directly related to climate change. So we have to take effective action on climate change and actually reverse it this century. Otherwise, we won't have polar bears anymore.
And does that happen to a lot of the polar bears out in the Arctic?
It happens sort of area by area. Climate change is not like a and sea ice loss is not sort of this even thing where the whole world's affected 1% at a time or something. It happens. It sort of fits and starts in different places of the world. So you have some populations of polar bears around the Arctic in different areas that are more affected than others. And it's when that sea ice loss also combines with other threats to their habitat, like oil drilling or seismic exploration or things like that, that you really see, larger population declines. It's double whammy.
Wow. And you seem to know a lot. Have you done a lot of research on polar bears, and have you worked with some people?
That's sort of like my job. If I refine it, it's like the very basic nature of it. It is to learn as much as possible about a topic by talking to experts and reading all the material, and then turning around and relating that and describing that to my audience. So that's one of the really cool things about my job, is I get to be professionally curious and then have access to all the tools and people necessary to learn as much as possible about the issues.
Okay, that's so cool. What's one of your favorite people that you've met that has taught you about polar bears?
I'm trying to think of a good example. personally, one of my best friends is this guy, Griff. And I was able to meet him through work, and he is a retired Army Ranger, combat veteran, served in Afghanistan, and is now trying to take economic opportunity and education for women into that country. So he's just like a very interesting, very positive, caring person, and I really enjoy his friendship.
Yeah, wow. That sounds interesting, too.
And you make friends like that, and then going back to polar bears, the preeminent polar bear scientist, this guy Stephen Ambrose, he was just fascinating. And being able to pick up the phone and call him and have him talk to me about, pulling David polar bears out of bins, to tag them, and all of his decades of experience in the Arctic is just super cool.
Yeah, wow. That has got to be so cool. Like, networking with people and meeting those kind of people in your career. And I think that's where journalism helps people out so much, because you meet so many interesting people, that other careers, I don't think you would meet the kind of people that you meet in journalism.
Yeah, that's totally true. We get to travel a lot. My job is to seek out interesting people. And then a lot of times, one of the most rewarding things about doing it is being able to turn like a big spotlight on those interesting people and like tell really cool stories about them and then help them along their path. So like Griff, for instance, the Army Ranger, the first story I ever wrote on him, that got him invited to come on Shark Tank. And the Sharks invested in his company, they made it viable for the first time. And his company again is providing economic opportunity and education for women in Afghanistan. That's a pretty worthwhile goal. So it really feels good when you get to do stuff like that and help people out that are doing really cool things.
Oh yeah, because I know with social media, it's helped me out a lot with just networking with people like from National Geographic or Discovery. Which is where I envision myself one day, and just meeting those kind of people. I just love their careers and love following them, and the fact that I can reach out and say hello and some of them get back to me, it's very, very interesting.
It's cool, and it's also really fun. As somebody with a cool career, and I really enjoy talking to my readers, and I really enjoy hearing their feedback and perspective on stuff that I've written, or issues that I want to cover in the future, or just hearing about the way that my work in some way, help them along in their own lives. And it's really rewarding getting to have those conversations.
Mm-hmm. And then speaking of your writing, I know you wrote this one piece about bleach and how you should drink it and it might just save your life. So tell me about that and how you wrote that.
So one of the ways that your goal with a publication is to sort of accrue as many readers as possible. And so you want to create content that resonates with people outside of just your regular everyday readership. And you want to create stuff that, you know, really goes out there and grabs people's attention. And so this was like last spring. Bleach in very small quantities, use disinfect water, is actually safe to drink. And because waterborne illnesses like Giardia and Cryptosporidium and things like that are so dangerous and so nasty to contract, you know, having diarrhea for a week on it is not fun. You know, it's important to put out also good information. We're like, hey, you know, drinking bleach can actually be a good thing to do. And it's relatively safe because, you know, the flavor of bleach makes it virtually impossible to drink quantities that would actually poison you. So, it's actually sort of an effective safety message. If, you know, hey, put a couple drops of bleach in water you find in the wilderness, or, you know, if I give a bowl of water advisor like I do in Texas right now, you know, that can make that water safe to drink. And so that was just sort of a fun opportunity to get like a useful, tangible, safety and an empowering outdoor recreation message in front of a lot of eyeballs because we're able to capitalize on, you know, the president's theatrics.
Oh, yeah. And then how did you decide to write about that? What made you write about that?
Oh, there were a lot of people criticizing the president for putting out that information and saying it was dangerous. And I was like, well, I happen to know that's not dangerous. And while I'm not a fan of Trump's, you know, it's a good opportunity just to, you know, put a cool message out there that's a little different from what most people probably assumed.
Okay. Yeah, because I just thought that was very interesting and it caught my attention. So, and that's definitely exactly what you want as a journalist.
That was the goal.
Yeah.
And now you know if you find yourself in a boil of water advisory because your state government is incompetent, that you, you know, if you have household bleach around, you can use that to make that water safe to drink.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very interesting. So I know that in one of your videos on rewilding, you said that camping in the outdoors helps with your anxiety. And I forget which video it was, but what tips have you learned in the outdoors that have helped with your anxiety and mental health? And why do you think that's important?
I think being outdoors really just helps people remain calm and feel centered and feel a really good connection to themselves. It's also empowering. You know, it's really cool to go out and try something hard and succeed at it. And just being out in a place that doesn't have cell phones ringing and people around and traffic and, you know, all that nasty stuff, and just being in a nice, calm environment where you can just enjoy yourself is really cool, especially in today's, you know, very crowded, very hectic world. My wife, Virginia, is a mental health therapist, and her practice here in Bozeman is called Off Grid Therapy. And so what she does is, you know, she takes her traditional talk therapy practice into the outdoors. So she'll do like a nature hike or a picnic or, you know, whatever with her clients. And it's an easier place for them to talk about their feelings and experiences and to work towards, you know, effective solutions.
Wow, that sounds like such a cool job. How did she get into that?
Yeah, she originally did organizational psychology. For a big consulting company, and just didn't find that super rewarding, and, you know, really found herself wanting to help people. And so she went back to school, got another advanced degree, and then had to spend like 4 years to get a license because therapy licenses are insane in this country. You know, worked with the practices, you know, just finally got to the point where she was licensed here in Montana, being licensed in California, and then was able to open her own practice last year. So it's been really exciting for both of us to see that happen.
Wow, so it was hard work, but she got there. Good for her.
Oh, yeah, it was a lot of hard work. You know, therapists have to spend 3 years working under the supervision of other people, basically for free, to get their license. It's a 3-year-long internship, which is an insane requirement. So it's as difficult as becoming a surgeon or, you know, something like that.
Wow, I didn't know that. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
I know that there's this therapy called forest therapy, and it's where...
Forest bathing.
Yeah. Can you tell me about that a little bit?
I don't know the technical aspects of it, but I guess there's been studies done, this is now a real practice, where simply spending time in nature has been demonstrated demonstrated to have positive correlations with mental health outcomes. And there's some theories out there about, like, the sounds or things that you're breathing in that are emitted by trees that, you know, scientific studies have shown just really going and sitting in the forest for a little bit every day can help you achieve positive outcomes.
Okay. So more positive mindset, and it helps your mental health too. So that's great.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And certain stress issues like anxiety and depression, you know, which obviously are very common in many of us sort of deal with.
Oh, yeah. And I know, like, right now with the pandemic, a lot of people are very, very depressed. And so I think that would be super beneficial to learn more about and write about. So, yeah, I'm going to look into that.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I hope. You know, the big picture of things that I hope my work achieves is that people feel more empowered to do more stuff outdoors and spend more time in nature. So, you know, trying to break down those barriers to entry for people that maybe didn't grow up with, you know, their parents showing them how to do this stuff, showing them how rewarding and sort of straightforward and easy it can be, and then making them excited to get out there. And so there's a big picture takeaway from my work. You know, that's one of the major things I hope I achieve.
Oh, yeah. And I think you do already. I love your writing. And I know. Yeah. So this is kind of random, but I know that you have a dog named Wiley. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
I have Wiley, my oldest dog. And then we have Glee, the middle dog, and Teddy, the youngest dog.
Oh, awesome. I love dogs. And I know you wrote an article for Outside called Exercise is the Secret to a Good Dog. And you were helping your friend's dog with recall. So, what's the best training you've taught Wiley in the outdoors? And what tips do you have for someone just starting out with training their dog in the outdoors?
Yeah, so dog training is really, really simple. You know, you ask the dog to do something and you give it a treat when it does it. And I think what a lot of people miss is that it's consistency and patience over time, and like never stopping and never giving up, that creates a well-trained dog. So specifically in the outdoors, you're able to, your dog gets exercise, your dog becomes satisfied, and when your dog is calm and happy, it's much easier to train them. So if you want your dog to sit, you know, taking it out and getting an exercise, taking it on a hike, and then coming back and then working on sit for 15 minutes with some treats, is going to be much more effective than trying to deal with a dog that's, you know, hasn't had enough exercise, hasn't had enough stimulation, just wants to bounce off the walls, right?
Mm-hmm. And then I know in the video that I watched, you took treats outside with the dogs. So why does that work? And what are the...
Well, you need to be doing your training. Mm-hmm. Once you've sort of gotten the basics down, you want to take your training into the environments where you want it to work. And so, like, one of the most important things that any dog needs to have is a reliable recall. And that's very, very challenging to achieve, you know, in a place like the mountains, because there's so much stimulation for them out there. You know, your recall needs to be more strongly associated in their minds with something you do than, you know, a squirrel chirping or deer running by or, you know, any other thing that might happen outside. And so it's challenging to get there, and it takes years, but you want your training to work in environments where it needs to work.
Okay, because I know with Wiley, you said it took around 3 years, I think, right?
Yeah, you know, you learn calm in 15 minutes, like any dog. The challenging thing is making calm reliable when there's distractions and potentially dangers. So I need him, you have a bear run through camp, I need him to turn around and, you know, listen to me, right?
Yeah.
It takes years to get to that point, which is the challenge. So taking it from that just normal, everyday around the house thing to something that might save their life one day is a huge challenge.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Wes, and I really appreciate that I got to interview you today. And thank you. All right, guys. Sorry, that last part got cut out a little bit, but that was my interview with Wes Seiler. I am very excited to know some of the magazines that he's worked for and the TV stations. It has been wonderful to interview him, and while we disagree on some things, I think that, you know, Wes Seiler has a different perspective on the world, and I think as born-again Christians, we should pray for him, and if you're not, that's okay. But thank you so much, you guys, and I really appreciate that you listened to this episode. I'm excited because for season 3, I'm going to have an equestrian TV presenter from Ride TV Network on the podcast, and she works at Ride TV Network, where I would love to work one day. So I'm very excited for that, and I can't wait for you guys to hear that. Thank you so much, and have a good day.